Coming up, another Russian exile ill. Is it poisoning? But first, President Bush is on his way back from Amman, Jordan. Did he accomplish what he set out to do? The trip was scheduled as a two-day summit with the idea that there would be some very frank talk with Iraq Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki about his handling of the deteriorating situation in Iraq. Not planned was the leak of a classified White House document critical of Maliki and the boycott of his government by lawmakers angry about the visit. Well, we spoke earlier today with L.A. Times White House correspondent Peter Walston just before he got on a bus in Amman to board his flight back to the U.S. Initial reports, it seemed that the White House canceled the meeting, but Peter writes today that, in fact, it was the Iraqis and the Jordanians who made that decision. I asked him about the discrepancy and what really happened.
Yes, Robin, it's interesting. You know, President Bush normally keeps very, you know, he's the one in control of his schedule, he and his staff, and they stick to the schedule incredibly well. But for some reason, this time, President Bush got on the plane in Riga, Latvia, on Wednesday, late afternoon, thinking that he was on his way to have a meeting with King Abdullah of Jordan and Prime Minister Maliki of Iraq. And midway through the flight, he got a phone call from the U.S. ambassador to Iraq saying that the decision was made that that meeting would not take place.
Oh, of course. Now, the question is why. And the speculation is it's because of, as you write, the disclosure of that White House memo leaked to the New York Times that questioned Maliki's ability to run Iraq, and the fact that members of the bloc, the Shiite bloc in parliament, loyal to the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, had announced they were going to boycott the government because of the meeting. That's the speculation as to why it was canceled.
Yes, that is the speculation. The White House denies that. They said it was merely a scheduling matter. But it really seemed like it had to be something more than that. I mean, I can't emphasize enough how rare. I mean, I've never seen it happen. You know, the president had been planning on this meeting. The White House finally acknowledged that, even as late as him getting on the plane on Air Force One to head to Jordan. So the president did go ahead with dinner and a meeting with King Abdullah separately. And you know, there's been some speculation, and some Jordanian sources have told some of my LA Times colleagues in the Middle East that the king really wanted time alone with President Bush. He wanted to talk about the Israel-Palestine issue. Now, everyone has a different story, but that seems to make some sense and could make sense. And then there's also the issue that Prime Minister Maliki had his own political headaches at home. He was taking heat for meeting with President Bush. Maybe this gave him a little bit of cover, but it's not clear that it would, since, of course, today he spent 2 hours with President Bush and did a press conference.
Well, let's talk about what did happen today. And I'm wondering, did it hurt the president's original initiative? Because the White House was saying that he was going to this meeting to talk tough to Prime Minister Maliki about the need for quelling the sectarian violence in Iraq. Did it hurt that mission? You know, the fact that he now was going into a meeting, perhaps, you know, apologizing for the leaked memo.
This was not a very good summit for the White House from our vantage point. I mean, this memo was leaked the day that the president was supposed to have this meeting. It had some very stunning accusations in it. The White House kept trying to say, look, you know, this memo just lays out ideas for fixing the problems in Iraq. It asks some questions. But if you read the text of the memo, it indicates that there was beginning to be some thinking in the White House about a shift in policy. And so what we saw today, interestingly, was the president really sticking by Maliki and sticking by his policy.
Yeah. And perhaps not able to be as tough as he had originally planned. But what did happen in the meeting?
What was presented was a report from a commission chaired by the two countries that would lay out ways to transfer authority over Iraqi troops from the U.S. to Iraqi provincial authorities.
An aide to the Iraqi prime minister has said it wouldn't be a big deal to handle the Mahdi army. This is the huge force that's loyal to the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. But we also understand that there was an agreement to accelerate the training of Iraq troops.
In general terms, and in principle, they agreed to that. But again, no specifics laid out as far as what exactly would happen, when it would happen, how many troops it would affect at first, and how long it would take to cover all Iraqi troops.
By the way, Peter, we know you have a bus to get on and a plane after that to come back to the U.S. You've already said you didn't think this was a very good summit. Anything else that you think came out of it? Any other observations?
Well, it's been certainly a difficult month for the president. It's the first week he starts off with some pretty major election losses, and then he went on another overseas trip to Asia, where he was greeted in Indonesia by protests and opposition to his policies. And here he came to the NATO summit in Latvia and was exhorting allies to contribute more resources to Afghanistan. It was supposed to be the war that was won, and now there's an insurgency there as well. So it's a bit of a, he's been a bit on the defensive, and he returns to Washington just in time to watch the Democrats take the majority.
LA Times correspondent Peter Walston in Amman, Jordan, about to get on a bus to come on home. Peter, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, it also sounds like a tough time to be a spokesperson for the president. Peter Walston was one of the confused reporters who met White House Communications Chief Dan Bartlett yesterday in Amman, trying to get to the bottom of the canceled meeting. The White House released a transcript, and it's a reminder of the art of Washington speak. Here's a portion read by our staff, picking up with a reporter's question after Bartlett explains that the trilateral last night, the meeting with Jordanian King, the Iraqi prime minister, and the president, had become a bilateral, just Maliki and the King of Jordan.
So the dinner is off, the three-way.
Right.
Well, if Maliki, he was never going to the dinner anyway, right? It was just supposed to be a meeting.
There was
going to
be a trilateral meeting and then dinner with the king. Now, since they already had a bilateral themselves, the King of Jordan and the Prime Minister, everybody felt, well, there's no reason for them to do a trilateral meeting beforehand because matters, well, they've been discussed.
So the scheduled trilateral is scrapped.
Right.
But the dinner, all three of them are still going to be at the dinner?
No.
Okay, so Maliki is not doing anything?
The president will see Prime Minister Maliki in the morning.
In the morning, okay.
So there's no three-way forum?
Correct.
I came in late. Where is Maliki?
I assume he's at his hotel. He's having dinner with somebody else tonight.
Why didn't he come here?
I just said that he had a meeting. He had a bilateral earlier today with the king.
Our reading of a transcript of yesterday's so-called press gaggle in Amman, Jordan. Well, each day seems to bring new twists in the case of the former KGB agent killed by a radioactive poison. 43-year-old Alexander Litvinenko, an outspoken critic of the Russian government, died last week after a massive dose of the element polonium-210. And now doctors of another Kremlin critic who suddenly fell ill say poisoning may also be the cause. Former Russian Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar became violently ill while at a conference in Ireland just a day after Litvinenko died. Gaidar's daughter told the BBC today that she feels her father may have been poisoned as a way to create suspicion of the Russian government.
It could have been interesting for some people who are fighting against Putin and who want destabilization in the country.
Well, this gets very confusing. And to help us sort it out, first we have Edward Lucas, Central and Eastern Europe correspondent for The Economist magazine in London. Edward, welcome.
Hello, Robin. Hello.
And also joining us on the line from Washington, David Satter, author of Darkness at the Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. He just returned from Moscow this week. David, welcome to you as well.
Oh, thanks very much.
And our first question to you, because, again, this is complicating. What do you make of these new allegations that the former prime minister, Gaidar, may also have been poisoned? We just heard from his daughter, who is generally an outspoken critic of Putin and Putin's Kremlin. But it sounds as if she's saying that it might have been critics, you know, and her father was a critic, who may have poisoned her father?
Well, there are different kinds of critics. For one thing, the critics who poisoned her father were not the same kind of critics that he was. Indeed, it may not have been critics at all who were involved. It may have been Putin's FSB, and it may have been under his direction.
And by the way, is it possible that he also wasn't poisoned? Where are we on that?
Well, with this, of course, we have no idea. Mm-hmm. But let's put it this way: if he suddenly fell sick, and it appears that he's been poisoned, then my intuitive feeling is that we should assume he has been poisoned,
right,
because
right.
There's too much of this going on for it to be a coincidence.
Right. And let's weave some of the web here. Gaidar's connection to Litvinenko is what?
Oh, not much, as far as I know. I mean, Gaidar's the former prime minister. He may have consulted with him, with Litvinenko, in one way or another. Litvinenko is really an outspoken critic.
And a former KGB agent. But there is the one tie that has been pointed out, that Andrei Lugovoy, another name,
yeah,
another former KGB spy who met with Litvinenko on the day he fell ill,
mm-hmm,
was also Gaidar's bodyguard at one point.
I wouldn't attach too much importance to that, because the fact is that Litvinenko had contacts through Boris Berezovsky. Boris Berezovsky was a key figure in the Yeltsin during the Yeltsin years, when Yeltsin was president of Russia.
Also in exile.
Gaidar was Yeltsin's prime minister. So there are various ways that could have been worked out. It doesn't mean that there's a direct connection between the poisoning of Litvinenko and the possible poisoning of Gaidar as a result of the fact that they're supplying bodyguards to each other.
And you mentioned Boris Berezovsky. He was also an exile living in London who had ties to Litvinenko. We will try to tease apart some of this in a moment, but I want to go to Ed Lucas from The Economist in London and just check in on the investigation, because we understand police there have found radioactive traces at 12 of 24 locations. And first of all, what do they tell us?
Well, I think it's very hard to read too much into this, because these are tiny, tiny traces. It's not as if someone's been going around London spraying polonium deliberately. This may be the poisoner or the poisoned may have left some traces as they went round London, and no one yet has produced a very substantive pattern. It's clear that Litvinenko went from the sushi bar where he was poisoned to Berezovsky's office, and that's where one of the places where polonium has been found. It's a bit more mysterious about the traces on the aircraft, and there's, I think, now five British Airways aircraft have been got traces of polonium on them, and they're trying to track down the all the passengers who've been on. That's very odd. One can imagine the poisoner perhaps coming and going on a British Airways plane, but why so many? And this will no doubt emerge during the course of the investigation.
And 30,000 people. I want to hold you for a second, because we got about a minute before the break, and just check in with David. You and others are saying, yes, these stories are trickling out, tragic, frightening, mysterious. But what also are they saying to you, just in a broad brush before we take the break?
What does it all say to me, that all of these events? Mm-hmm. It indicates to me that the part of the leadership that is interested in establishing a more fascistic regime is using these killings to make a bid for power. That's what it says to me.
Does it say that this new Russian Kremlin, many former KGB agents put into high offices, as you point out, by Putin, may be tripping up in that climb to power?
I doubt they're tripping up, because it looks to me that that everything is going according to plan. We just don't know what the plan is.
Right, except they've left quite a few radioactive traces. That's David Satter, his author of Darkness at the Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. We're also talking to Edward Lucas of The Economist. We'll be back with both of them with more on this intriguing and to many Londoners frightening story coming out of London. Much more ahead here and now. Talking about the ever-expanding mystery around the death of former KGB spy Alexander Litvinenko with David Satter, an author, a fellow at the Hudson and Hoover Institutes. David just saying that he felt this was part of a bigger story of a climb to power of fascistic officials in Russia. And also Ed Lucas is with us at The Economist magazine in London. And Ed, you were about to give us your overriding thought about this. What is that?
Well, I agree with everything that my old friend David has said, but I would add a couple of points. I think that although we can't quite work out what's going on, it's clear it's very nasty, and that murder has become the common currency of politics and, to some extent, diplomacy in modern Russia. Whether this is a sinister faction in the Kremlin trying to worsen even further the relations between Kremlin and the West in order to then prepare the ground for some kind of hardline put or suspension of the Constitution, or whether this is just Putin himself giving warnings to various categories of people, we don't know. But I think that it's rather like the Soviet Union used to. We didn't quite know who was up and who was down in the Politburo in the 20s and to some extent in the 30s and at other points, but we did know that it was very nasty and we weren't going to benefit. And that's why we've been discussing the idea of whether we're in a new Cold War.
David says that the Russians give as reason for this as for the death of Litvinenko and the poisoning as surrealistic as any offered by the Soviets during the Cold War. As you were saying, David, before the break, they're blaming it on Boris Berezovsky, who is another exile critical of the Kremlin, who was a friend of Litvinenko, who was poisoned.
Yes, and not only that, he's a friend, supporter, and someone who agrees with him. The problem that we're facing, is, as Edward, I think, has indicated, is that to untangle this web of events, we've got to start at the very beginning, and that's not going to be easy. Let me give you as brief a summary as possible. What happened was that under Yeltsin, who enjoyed very wide, you know, really unflinching support from the West, and particularly from the United States, Russia was pillaged. The country's standard of living, such as it was, collapsed. There was a huge increase in the death rate, which was directly attributable to the change in conditions. And a very small number of people were able to abscond with the wealth that was created by the combined efforts of the entire population. And by the time Yeltsin's second term came to an end, there was real fear among the persons who had illegally, dishonestly, and unethically acquired all this property that it would be taken away from them, that they would be put in jail, or maybe worse. And as a result, it became imperative for them, and one of these people was Boris Berezovsky, to put someone into power who would protect them, and that person was Putin. 1999, there were mysterious explosions in Moscow, Volgodonsk, and Buynaksk.
In the apartment buildings, right.
That took 300 lives. The explosions were attributed to Chechens. A new war was launched. Putin, elevated from the FSB to be prime minister, was put in charge of this new war.
The security board, yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the war was initially successful. As a result of that, Putin gained popularity. All of the anger of the country against the pillaging was redirected against the Chechens, and Putin won in a landslide.
But now?
Now, just hang on. Listen, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to do all this.
No, that's okay.
We'll never understand it if we don't. Once that had happened, Putin pardoned Yeltsin and his family for all crimes committed, and he hasn't been touched. But Boris Berezovsky, having engineered this brilliant operation, expected to be rewarded and continued to be a major power, and Putin disappointed in him. And in fact, when Berezovsky overreached, it became clear that he was a candidate for criminal prosecution by Putin, and he fled the country. So he's in London. Now, having lost power, Berezovsky began to say that Putin was responsible for the FSB, was responsible for the apartment bombings.
That voice had to be silenced.
What?
And that had to be silenced,
well,
as did other voices.
They mm-hmm. tried to. I mean, Berezovsky's mm-hmm. well-guarded. He's got a lot of money. Now, he, in turn, began to patronize Alexander Litvinenko, who was a FSB defector who at one time warned of a plot to kill Berezovsky when he was even in Russia. But Litvinenko's now been murdered, okay? Mm-hmm. The Russian authorities want to blame it on Berezovsky, saying because in the years that Berezovsky's been outside of the country, he's been converted into a kind of hate figure as a symbol of the pillaging that took place under Yeltsin. All the other pillagers are still in power because they made their peace with Putin and are prospering as before. So the situation now is that when the Russians are told about, for example, events like the murder of Litvinenko or even the murder of Anna Politkovskaya,
the journalist,
everything bad that happens in Russia is attributed to Berezovsky.
And David, if I could just butt in there, I think this is a very classic kind of echo of the Soviet past, that the idea of blaming everything on wicked foreign cosmopolitan Zionist whatever, this is a classic feature of European totalitarianism in the last century and something we should be very worried about. And it's not just Berezovsky being made into a hate figure, also the Georgians, for example, are being highlighted as a kind of evil, sinister force within Russia that has to be deported and eradicated. And it's all part of this dreadful descent into a kind of, you know, xenophobic authoritarianism, which the Economist a few weeks ago said really was going to end up as fascism.
And which David Satter writes, the West can no longer overlook, as it has overlooked many indiscretions in Russia, but now that it's on British soil, it can no longer be overlooked.
Absolutely.
And may fundamentally change the relationship between Russia and the West. Well, we thank you both, gentlemen. We teased it apart a little. It gets curiouser and curiouser, and we'll have you back as it goes. Edward Lucas of The Economist in London, David Satter, author and fellow at the Hudson and Hoover Institutes. We thank you both.
Thank you.
And we didn't even get in there that according
gee,
to...
I didn't realize we had so little time.
You'll be back. You'll be back, David. Thank you so much. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from W...
On November 3rd, during morning rush hour, a man stood near an off-ramp of a major highway in downtown Chicago, doused himself with gasoline, and set himself on fire. A sign found near his body read, "Thou shalt not kill." It took officials 5 days to identify the remains of 52-year-old Malachi Richter, a well-known and well-respected Chicago recording engineer. But the reason for his suicide remains somewhat of a mystery. Was it the insane act of a man with a history of depression, or a final protest against the war in Iraq? And either way, why didn't more Americans hear about it? Some of the leading news outlets in Chicago didn't even report it. Well, we're going to try to answer these questions, starting with Bruno Johnson, a record producer in Milwaukee who's known Malachi Richter for 20 years. Bruno, we understand that you got a package from your friend in the mail on the day he died?
Yes, I did.
What was in that?
House keys, his last will and testament, and a 2-page list of things for me to look for in his house.
Did you know at this time that it was Malachi? Did you know what had happened?
No, I didn't know what had happened. When I got the letter on Monday morning, I started calling friends in Chicago to see if anybody had seen him, and then I drove down there, and about halfway there, I found out it was him.
Well, how do you react to something like that? Was this something where you said, gee, that's something I might have expected, unexpected?
It was unexpected on my part. I was shocked. He was very committed and passionate, and it really became less and less of a shock to me and more of an act that I would not be surprised that he had done.
Well, a letter has been released that he wrote, and he talks about, you know, venomously about America's role in the war in Iraq.
Yes. Yeah, he was very politically active, very angry with our, not just our war in Iraq, but our general international relations, I believe.
And yet, he also had a history of depression.
That's what people said to me. I really never noticed it in him. He was always a very quiet man, but I never really thought of him as particularly depressed. Yeah.
Do you wonder at all, having read his mission statement, which is his letter that he left,
mm-hmm.
about the level of anger he had? One thing that struck me is he passed Donald Rumsfeld in Washington, D.C., and as he writes, "I was acutely aware that slashing his throat would spare the lives of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of innocent people. I had a knife clenched in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
There were no bodyguards. To my deep shame, I hesitated." That's quite striking, and that was in 2002. That's a lot of anger to be carrying.
Well, I almost kind of wish he hadn't put that in there, because so many people do kind of focus on it. A lot of people write dark secrets that they wish they could have acted on at some point, and, you know, he didn't, and maybe he did regret that. I don't think he could have done it, knowing the man I knew.
He also had hoped that the way he chose to die might make some change, and yet... You know, hardly anyone knew. Do you think it will change anything, or?
No, I certainly hope so. I hope it at least makes people think about what we're doing and more aware of what's going on. I mean, I'm only 45, but I certainly remember Vietnam, and I remember images of coffins coming home. I remember images of Buddhist monks self-immolating, and that war was fought out more in the media. This one is a little more hidden. Coffins come home in the middle of the night, nobody really sees them. The president doesn't go to funerals. it's like we're at this war, but we don't really think we're at war. And I think if this helps people realize that not only are thousands of Americans dying, but tens of thousands of Iraqis, maybe we'll start thinking about that a little more seriously.
We're speaking with Bruno Johnson. He runs the jazz label Oka Disc in Milwaukee. And we've been talking about his friend, the late Malachi Richter, who committed suicide by self-immolation earlier this month in Chicago, he said in writings, in protest of the war in Iraq. Bruno, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Peter Margasak, a reporter who pieced together the facts about Malachi Richter's death and wrote about it in the Chicago Reader. Peter, the Chicago Tribune has just this week written about this story, which has sparked a lot of questions in and of itself. What are yours about that?
That it took them almost a month to cover it?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, it seems like a big subject is whether suicide is something that's a touchy subject to cover. I think certain publications might feel a responsibility that they don't want to be the cause of any kind of copycat act.
And the Chicago Tribune and other papers have said that. And yet this wasn't just a suicide, it was a war protest.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what it was. I mean, on the surface, you know, it's certainly couched that way with the signs that Malachi held up and the stuff on his website. But I think a reading of his website also indicates to me that there's a chance that he was disturbed in other ways. I mean, you have to be pretty upset to kill yourself.
Well, but that has raised a lot of questions, and I'm sure, you know, you've been asking them as well. We've been debating this quite a bit in the office. You know, people have said, well, you know, was he mentally ill? As if that would dismiss his anger at the war. And, you know, in response, I mentioned at one point, well, you know, the young Chinaman who stood in front of the tank at Tiananmen Square, if the tank had rolled him over, you would have said, well, that was crazy to stand in front of a tank. And yet...
Yeah, I mean, you can't... There's no question he was angry. I mean, and his anti-war views have been were nothing new. I mean, on the website that he maintained that was kind of a calendar for music, jazz, and experimental music in Chicago, there were always, in fact, it's still up. I mean, it lists a lot of anti-war figures, like a kind of a ongoing counter of how much money and how many lives have been wasted in Iraq. You know, he was arrested on several occasions for protesting downtown. So it wasn't, this just didn't come out of the blue. He didn't make this up. I mean, he was very vehement. The best I can piece it together, my best hunch is that he was not happy being alive, and, you know, he didn't want to live anymore. And I think he saw it as an opportunity to make a very profound statement about the war.
Well, and now there are people who, you know, through your writing, have heard about what happened. And one of them, a young woman named Jennifer Diaz, has organized a loose-knit group of people who calling themselves I Heard You Malachi, are going to commemorate his death this Sunday and are trying to get his story well known. But even his family is split. His brother thinks that what he did was an honorable form of protest. His son thinks it was a waste of his dad's life. I mean, there's probably just going to be that divide.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever going to be a definitive explanation for what he did. I mean, if you in his self-penned obituary, he said he had no friends. And the fact is, a lot of people knew Malachi and would speak with him at any given time, either at work or at jazz clubs. I mean, he was a pretty social person. But beyond those kind of interactions, he wouldn't call someone up and like, hey, let's go get a cup of coffee. It just didn't happen. And the thing on the Reader website, the blog post that I put up that's got several hundred comments now, it's people playing armchair psychologists. And I mean, I think part of it is people are trying to make some semblance of a pretty, you know, intense act. So I think they're kind of inserting their own meanings into it to make sense of it for themselves, because otherwise it's, you know, it's hard to fathom, like, why this would happen and, you know, someone that would be driven to this. I mean, it's pretty disturbing.
Peter Margasak, reporter for the Chicago Reader, on Malachi Richter, a Chicago sound engineer who committed suicide by self-immolation in a self-proclaimed protest of the war in Iraq. We also spoke with Bruno Johnson, a Milwaukee record producer, who's preparing a tribute to Malachi by compiling a CD of some of the recordings that Malachi made. We leave you with one. It features jazz saxophonist Ken Vandermark. It's called Would a Proud Man Rather Break Than Bend? You're listening to Here and Now. Let's turn to sports, as we always do on Thursday. And it could be a very dry December for World Cup skiers and their fans because of a shortage of snow in Europe and a shortage of dough in the U.S. World Cup officials say there's not enough sponsorship support for Colorado resorts to stage some of the ski races that have already been scrapped because of warm weather and a lack of snow in Europe. Only game host Bill Littlefield has slalomed into the studio to talk about this and other things from the worlds of sports. Bill, how big is this?
Well, let me just catch my breath after slaloming into the studio.
Yes,
I've never been accused of slaloming anywhere before. It seems to me that the critical statistic here, Robin, is that these races will not be staged in Colorado, apparently for the lack of $350,000. I mean, you know, you go into an NBA locker room, slip that much out of the wallets of the combined members of one team, and nobody would notice it was gone.
Right.
So this has got to say something about the state of World Cup skiing, at least in this country, where it has never been such a big deal, of course, as it is in Europe.
And they've given a definitive statement about it.
Yeah, isn't that great? The man in charge of the World Cup in the U.S. has said, quote, "The money is not there, so that's the final decision right now." It reminds me of my days negotiating teachers' contracts, you know, where we kept getting final offers.
And this is it.
Yeah, for now.
Well, but still, it's really weird. Parts of Colorado got nearly 3 feet of snow in a 48-hour period. Not enough snow in the Alps, and it's springtime here in Boston today, so it just is odd what's happening.
It certainly is.
And how it's affecting the world of sports. And staying with winter sports, I understand there will be no women's ski jumping in the Vancouver Winter Olympics in 2010. What happened? That was supposed to be a new sport?
Yeah, well, there were numbers of people trying to get it on the list of sports, and ski jumping is one of only two Winter Olympic events that women don't compete in. Of course, they play ice hockey now and do all the other things the men do. They will not be ski jumping, though, and apparently the rationale is very much the same as the rationale has been in deciding not to include other sports in summer and winter Olympics, and that is, A, not enough countries have teams that have enough women who can do this well, and then more generally not enough women in the world do it well. And, of course, the women who do ski jump expertly have argued that that's a lot of nonsense and that this is a sport that should be included.
Let's turn to the NBA quickly. What's the deal with the Atlantic Division? No one, including our very own Boston Celtics, has a winning record.
One might say especially our very own Boston Celtics, who lost last night to the Nets.
And, you know, you mentioned the money that you could get in a wallet in one of these locker rooms. People are asking, are these guys being paid to play like this? And then also, are people paying to see them?
Well, it is a very bizarre collection of bad teams in that particular division, no question about that. And there is, I guess there is a possibility that one of them will, get into the playoffs by winning the division and winning fewer games than they lose, although that's very unlikely. The Nets are, in fact, a good basketball team, as they have demonstrated over the past several years. And I think they probably will break away from the pack. They're more likely to do that than the Celtics, certainly.
Mm-hmm. College football coming down to the final weekend to see who plays Ohio State for the national championship in January. Southern Cal will probably be the choice if the Trojans beat their old rivals UCLA this weekend. Tell me, by the way, what you think of that thinking. And why can't there just be a playoff for college football?
The argument, and it's an old argument, that there should be a playoff is, of course, that it would give us a definitive national champion, and that's a lovely idea, and many people think it's very important. And the argument against is it would push the football season even further along the calendar and make it even more obvious that the college football players at the football factories masquerading as universities would be even less likely to pay any attention to anything other than football. So I personally like the idea that there is no definitive playoff, because I like the idea of lots and lots of teams claiming we're number one at the end.
And waving those big foam fingers,
you know,
as
they
do.
Also, the Bell Helicopter Armed Forces Bowl would not be nearly so important if there were a national championship.
Bill Littlefield hosts NPR's Only a Game every weekend. Be sure and check it out. Bill, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. David Carradine, still ahead, here and now. And now, our next topic, not everyone's cup of tea, but wildly successful, director Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill films, Volumes 1 and 2, star Uma Thurman as the former member of a gang of killers called the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad. Her ex-gangmates show up on her wedding day to kill her, even though she's very pregnant, and her entire wedding party. Delightful. The bride is shot, but she's the only one who survives, and years later comes out of her injury-induced coma and takes out her would-be assassins one by one, including their leader, Bill, the father of her child, and the man who put a bullet in her brain.
This moment, this is me and my most masochistic.
Bill? It's your baby.
That's David Carradine as Bill. Carradine, best known for his role as Kwai Chang Kane in the 1970s martial arts TV series Kung Fu.
The years have been good. Quiet and measured. Flowing slowly. Like water.
Well, among Kung Fu's fans was director Quentin Tarantino. Are you following this? His casting of Carradine in the Kill Bill films made the actor a dark horse candidate for an Oscar nomination. Now Carradine has written The Kill Bill Diary about what it was like creating the character and the effect it's had on his career. He spoke with Here and Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham.
You say in the book's prelude that Quentin makes movies featuring cult people who can't get work. Is that the way you saw yourself?
Well, I was always working,
mm-hmm.
but it's a question of, you know, what kind of work. The budgets of the movies and whether they're going to be released straight to DVD or their television or they're going to be on the big screen. I was not doing very much work on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Quentin is a junk collector, and he collects this junk and then he sells it at a profit.
Right.
And in the process, he resurrects some junk. And, mm-hmm. Definitely, he improved my outlook and the industry's outlook towards me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I came very close to getting nominated. I was nominated for the Golden Globe.
Mm-hmm.
I got tons of just incredible reviews from everybody. Yeah, it was a very good trip for me.
Just as a little refresher for people who haven't seen the movie, and I can't imagine who those people might be, you play Bill, a savage killer. But he's also a man who has a defined sense of style and humor and even a kind of old-world nobility. How important was it for you to find a way to portray some kind of humanity in this world-class killer?
Well, he's also, you know, he's a great father in his own strange way. And he's also really very much in love with this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole character was pretty easy to find because Quentin actually wrote it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of about me, not that I'm an international assassin.
Right.
But he was reading, you know, I wrote an autobiography called Endless Highway, and mm-hmm. he was reading that while he was writing the movie, and he just automatically had Bill talk like me, or at least talk the way I write.
But he was also envisioning Warren Beatty in the role, even though he was hearing your voice.
No, he
perhaps.
Wasn't. He wasn't, actually. They offered the part to Warren. That was part of getting the deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that happened, well, actually, I know it, was that they got to the point where they were actually starting into pre-production, and then Uma announced that she was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized they had to wait a year before they could shoot. Well, if you can imagine Quentin Tarantino and Warren Beatty trying to keep a sort of a romance going for an extra year,
mm-hmm.
it just wasn't going to work. And then Warren... Well, Quentin just kept saying to Warren, you know, if you could kind of be like David Carradine
right.
here. And finally, Warren just said, why don't you just hire David?
Mm-hmm.
And that gave Quentin his out.
In reading the book, you had this wonderful rapport with Quentin, so much so that I guess when you talk about being in a cigar bar, I think, in Beijing, and you're talking mm-hmm. about superheroes and you're talking about Superman, and 6 days later you get a script, and that scene is in the movie.
A staple. The superhero mythology is there's the superhero and there's the alter ego. Batman is actually Bruce Wayne. Spider-Man is actually Peter Parker. When that character wakes up in the morning, he's Peter Parker. He has to put on a costume to become Spider-Man. And it is in that characteristic Superman stands alone. Superman didn't become Superman. Superman was born Superman.
I showed up to do it, and I had gone through a lot of trouble to get the words down perfectly because, you know, Quentin's kind of a stickler about that. And then the day I showed up, he threw the script away and kind of started over. And there was a lot of the original script in there, but he changed everything. Quentin never stopped writing. Right up till the end of the movie, he was constantly second-guessing himself. And, you know, in the original script, when Warren was in the picture, it was going to be, I was going to be in a tuxedo, and there's a banquet table with servants. And then he just said, you know, I forget that. I think I'm just going to have you make a sandwich.
The great sandwich scene, the most meticulous sandwich ever made on screen.
Right, and waving that big knife around, everybody thinks something's going to happen here any second. That was an awful, all of it was so much fun. But, you know, my favorite scene actually was the one in front of the church and in the church where Uma and I meet up for the first time in the movie.
Why are you here?
Last look.
Are you going to be nice?
I've never been nice my whole life. But I'll do my best to be sweet.
I always told you, your sweet side is your best side.
I guess that's why you're the only one who's ever seen it.
Before we were shooting, Quentin said, I think this is your best scene in the movie. And I said, I think it's the best scene in my whole career.
What about that scene is so special for you?
The audience knows from the very beginning that this is when I'm going to shoot her in the head. But yet, what we're playing is just a love scene between the two of us with no hint of that. And then that final kiss, you know, when I think up until that moment, if she just said, to hell with this wedding, I'm coming back and living with you and we'll have the baby and bring her up, that he'd say, cool, and call off the Viper Squad.
Right.
But she doesn't. She goes through with it. And there's that beautiful kiss. Every once in a while, Quentin would let us ad-lib, but it was always kind of a plan. Like he said to her, ask him how you look. And he didn't tell me what to answer. And, you know, what else could I say looking at Uma Thurman and that when she lifted up the veil and this light hits like a halo?
Right.
And she says, do I look pretty? And what could I say? But, oh, yeah.
It's one of the signature scenes in the film. What I found really interesting when I watched the film on DVD after seeing the theater was you had this big fight scene with Michael Jai White, which you had trained months and months for, and it didn't make the final cut, even though it is available as a deleted scene on the DVD.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your disappointment with that scene not making it into the final film?
Well, the disappointment was pretty brief. You know, I felt bad for Michael Jai White, who could have used the exposure.
Right.
But very quickly I realized that, you know what this means? It means that Quentin did not hire me because I'm a martial artist or because of kung fu or anything.
Right.
He actually hired me because he likes the way I act.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows I can, you know, kick and punch and all that kind of thing. And it was nice to have an opportunity to show him that I could give a performance that would almost get me walking up that red carpet.
Actor David Carradine speaking with Here Now's Renee Graham. His book is The Kill Bill Diary, The Making of a Tarantino Classic as Seen Through the Eyes of a Screen Legend. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.